Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Advisors behaving badly. It is rare, but it happens. What do you do if you think it has happened to you? Osgoode Hall Law School's Investor Protection Clinic has just released a series of educational videos to explain the process. Jesse Armour, one of the leaders on that project, will be here to tell us more. Then a Google search can help you find almost anything. So what is the anything that Canadians have been searching for when it comes to their money? SEMrush analyzed thousands of these searches. I'll speak with Fernando Angulo about their findings. And millennials on the move. But where exactly? Where are they moving to? Monique Johnson from Your Happy Realtor will talk to us about some of the trends she's seeing when it comes to millennials and home buying. And certified financial planner Jackie Porter takes us through her financial journey. It's quite an extraordinary tale. Plus, a new podcast about money for kids called Million Bazillion. I'll speak to its host, Jed Kim. He may have more energy than me, if that is possible. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. The price of pizza. This is a major personal finance topic for a particular subset of the population. Young people, they care about this stuff. They may not be interested in bond yields or price to earnings multiples, but it is easy to get animated about the most glorious food ever created in the history of humankind. Jed Kim is the host of Million Bazillion, a podcast about money for kids and their families. He knows something about the price of pizza, and he also knows something about how to get kids engaged in the topic of money. He joins us now from Glendale, California. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
I think I have met my energy match. There are not a lot of people, and you haven't even uttered a word yet, but I've been listening to your show, and you actually radiate at a level that matches my own.
It takes a lot of coffee and a lot of sugar. That's part of my routine before I start recording.
Very smart. I don't even need any of those artificial stimulants. I think people would take sedatives and just bring it back
24/7.
Jeez. Tell us about Million Bazillion. How did it come about? What are you trying to do?
Million Bazillion is a podcast by Marketplace, the national show from APM. And Marketplace's whole mission is to raise the economic intelligence of the country. And, you know, for a long time, that has meant raising the economic intelligence of adults. But it was just a matter of time before they got to kids and they decided our schools are completely falling down on the job. Most parents don't know enough about money and or are uncomfortable talking about it to their kids. And so there's just this real need to get kids thinking about money. And they want to know.
They're curious about it, but it takes something because they're used to TikTok. They're used to YouTube. They are not used to or interested in CNBC. So I listened to the pizza episode and the kids talked about their dream pie. It was like gold crust, toppings of fruit leather pepperoni, edible glitter, blended stars, and shredded moon. But what you were getting at, which I loved, is why pizza costs what it costs. What is your way in to these topics? How do you wrap your mind around what's going to be engaging for your target audience?
So we're really lucky that we have a great network of parents, a lot of coworkers and friends who we can tap into to ask them, you know, hey, can you ask your kid what they want to know about money? And we did that. And one of the things that kept coming back was that kids wanted to understand why things cost what they do, because it really, if you even think about it as an adult, might not really make that much sense.
Well, and on the pizza episode, it was labor. Like, you took the cost of the dough and the cost of the cheese and all that stuff. But one of the real insights was actually what you're paying for is the people who make it and serve it. And that's worth it. And that's valuable. There's topics are one thing. They're also sort of a value set that all of us bring to any conversation about money. And it's not universal how we feel about things and how we value things. How do you imbue the stories with a set of values that is inclusive?
Well, we want our listeners to start thinking about money in a way that we want them to think about money as adults. And so that's not necessarily setting them on a path to try to make as much as possible. You know, we want them to think about how their choices are going to affect other people. And so when it comes to the pizza episode, you know, one of the points that someone we interviewed made was that if you find a place that is selling pizza for very little money, I mean, there's a reason why that's the case. And instead of just thinking about, oh, this is a great deal, you might want to think about what corners they're cutting to get that price. And a lot of times that might mean not treating their employees as well as they could.
You include the voices of kids in the show, which is delightful. I mean, this is where the, you know, the glitter and the shredded moon came from. What has surprised you about hearing them talk about these things in the way that only kids can talk about things?
What's been surprising is that they just understand so much more than we think. Like, they're making connections all the time. They're watching their parents. And even if you're not sitting down with your kid and giving them little tips or lessons about money, they're still picking it up. And so when they see the way that you buy things, the decisions that you make, the stress that you have, they're internalizing that. And the danger is that if you're not talking to them, if they're not getting a proper education, the things they might be internalizing might not be what you want them to be doing.
I have a 10-year-old, and the personal finance topic that I think about the most, that I'm concerned about the most, is credit card use. And how do you teach someone that they actually have a finite amount of money when our culture and the enablers of the credit cards do everything to convince them otherwise? How have you been thinking about that broad topic on Million Bazillion?
Well, if and when season two comes around, we're going, tackle credit cards at that point. But for now, we are having our kids think about just the basic concepts of budgeting and thinking long terms and short term. Like, what would make me really happy now, but what would I be missing out in the future? And I think credit cards are going to have to be a big part of that when we get around to it.
Student loan debt, it probably a little early for your target audience, but US, that is a massive, massive burden for young people.
Yeah. And it's just for the longest time been just accepted that, oh, of course you're going to have student debt. And I mean, I was the same way, but then it's just this thing that lives with you for years and years. And I remember when my partner and I finally, you know, paid off our student loans, we had a huge celebration because it had taken so much longer than we thought it would. And when it comes to teaching the kids, I mean, that's something we struggled with because we don't want to tell them, well, don't get student loans, because the opportunities that could come with borrowing money to get a good education, I mean, how can you deny that?
But you come to this topic not as a financial advisor, but as a storyteller. So what has been one of your big ahas for yourself that I'm sure you had to pretend wasn't an aha? You're like, oh my God, I totally always knew that. What?
I'm definitely not a financial advisor. I am actually more of a financial illiterate. But one of the things that really surprised me was from our very first episode, a lot of kids wanted to know like where money comes from and why it works. And in the course of like preparing for it, we were saying, well, of course, we're going to talk about bartering because that's how money came about. But when we started speaking with experts, we learned that bartering anecdote that you learn from your econ class, that's not necessarily accurate. Like, we didn't need money just because it was much more efficient than trading seashells for corn. Money came about more as just kind of a way to improve our relationships with each other and build community, and that it was kind of like receipts to show, hey, I'm in this together with my neighbor. And that really struck me because, like, at the moment in history when coins became a thing, like, yeah, you could see all the upsides, but then it immediately kind of severed that relationship between buyer and seller. And that really blew my mind.
Fascinating stuff. I'm gunning for a season two for you, Jed, because I think the show is fantastic. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Bruce.
Jed Kim is the host of Million Bazillion. It is a podcast about money for kids and families. You really got to check it out.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The vast majority of financial professionals are good people doing good work, but there are exceptions. If you suspect your financial institution or someone who works there has mishandled your money, going to court is not the only solution. There are a number of options out there that you should consider maybe first. Osgoode Hall Law School's Investor Protection Clinic has released a series of videos that takes you through the different options that you have. Jesse Armour helped lead that project. She joins me now. Hello there.
Hello.
What was the purpose behind the creation of these videos? Were you just sick of answering the same questions over and over and over again?
No, I think, you know, truly the video series, the Points of Interest series, is the Osgoode Investor Protection Clinic's contribution to investor education. And I think last fall when we first started to think about how we might be able to contribute in that space, initially it was a podcast turned into a video series. 60% of the clinic's clients identify as having low or no investment knowledge. And the clinic strongly believes that better educated, informed investors are better protected. And so these videos are really more to provide, whether it be our clients or the public at large, with as much information as possible to be able to decipher if they have a complaint and what to do with it if they identify one.
One of the episodes is about reporting a wrongdoing, which I think is really, really important. What is the first indication that an investor might have that something is amiss?
So identifying a wrongdoing can be very difficult. I think in part, obviously, because investing is inherently risky. And so ebbs and flows in an account statement from month to month are not necessarily going to be a clear indicator. Signs of mismanagement, I'll give you an example of one. So advisors have a responsibility to know their clients and recommend investments that are suitable. If you find, for example, that your investment portfolio isn't reflecting the goals, needs, and your risk tolerance that you've expressed to your advisor in the past, that might be an indication that your investments are being mishandled and requires further investigation.
What are some other examples that you're in a situation in which wrongdoing has occurred?
So one could be if you are noticing that your funds are being used in a way that you weren't informed of. If there are fees showing up on account statements that, you know, weren't explained to you. If you have trade activity that's resulting in high commissions or trading fees, and that's not the strategy that you discussed with your advisor, there's a sense there that there may be something wrong and your investments are being mishandled.
For clients that come to the Investor Protection Clinic, they may well have tried a number of other things first. What would be those other things? Is the first call to the financial professional directly, or is it to the ombudsman of a firm? What are the other things that they should do before they pick up the phone and call you?
So before picking up the phone and calling the clinic, I'll take you back initially to ideally what investors are doing prior to even identifying a complaint. Clients should be performing due diligence, or investors should be performing due diligence in advance of investing with a certain advisor, which means that you're checking registration to ensure that the person providing you with the investment advice is licensed to do so. You can also check disciplinary history to see if that your advisor has been disciplined in the past for misconduct. And there's a good resource that the Ontario Security Securities Commission has called checkbeforeyouinvest.ca. That's a good place to do that. You also want to be maintaining notes and records of your account statements, staying engaged and asking questions when they come up. Documenting conversations and writing as much as possible, retaining documents and statements related to the investment. If ever, you know, you're coming to the clinic, we would ask you for what evidence you have, and that will be critical to achieving a successful outcome. So those are kind of the more proactive aspects. If you do identify a complaint, one thing that you, as you've mentioned, the first thing you should do is contact the firm or institution. That should be your first step. In part, because should you have to escalate the complaint further, there will be instances that require that you went to the firm first. So it is a good first step. And it may be the last step. There are certainly cases at the Investor Protection Clinic where we've dealt with negotiated settlements with the firm that have recouped a significant amount of an investor's losses. So sending in a complaint letter, documenting what the concern is, any relevant information you have on hand is certainly important. And you should know that firms are required to respond generally to your complaint within 90 days of receiving a written letter.
I'm sure you have to manage expectations for clients that come and see you in terms of A, their ability to have a positive resolution, and B, what sort of compensation is available to them. How do you answer the question on compensation? What could it look like in a case where wrongdoing absolutely occurred and there is a remedy that has been negotiated?
It certainly will vary depending on the case, of course. That said, if there is a situation where we have an investor, for example, someone who is nearing retirement, who had intended to be investing in low risk options, but was instead put into a higher risk securities, for that type of client, what we would look at when assessing compensation is, what would a normal or how would a normal retirement fund have performed over the years? And how did that actually occur with the client? How did their portfolio perform, comparing the two and, you know, deducting to see, okay, well, what if this money had been invested properly? Where would the account stand today? And that can sometimes be how we would compensate the loss. So it could be in the case that I'm, you know, thinking of, over $100,000, but that would be based on, you know, what loss you can quantify as part of the financial analysis, and the clinic certainly helps with that step.
How often do these situations occur? I mean, I think in general, it is super important for investors to be aware, to watch out, to, as you say, do the due diligence on their own. But how big is the risk empirically?
So I don't have a clear stat on that. However, I will say that the firm is generally at capacity. So this is a real live issue for Canadian investors. That said, you know, I will caveat by saying that we're not always dealing with clients who have gone to the big investment firms or banks. We also have clients who have dealt with issues of fraud with unregistered advisors or individuals who are, you know, preying on members of certain groups to have them invest in scam opportunities. So, you know, certainly we're at capacity, and so it's certainly a live issue for investors in Canada.
Well, Jesse, thanks for coming and telling us more about it. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
The video series is called Points of Interest, and it is available at Investor Protection Clinic, which is part of the Osgoode Hall Law School. So do a search for that and learn more. Super important stuff. And fingers crossed, you're never in a situation of having to call for their services, but they are there if you do need them. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, I'll speak to real estate expert Monique Johnson about millennial home buying trends, or condo buying trends, whatever it is. And later, from being financially dependent and having a whole bunch of circumstances thrown at her at a very young age to a seven-figure net worth, I'll speak to Jackie Porter, certified financial planner, about her financial journey. And for all other things Moolah La, sign up for our newsletter. It comes once a month, and it brings together all sorts of fun stuff that I have done on this show, CBC Radio, CityLine, BNM Bloomberg. If you sign up, I promise the email address will live with me and only with me, and I'll never do anything with it.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
This pandemic has brought on a whole new meaning to the word home. It was a place to eat and sleep, and, you know, you'd leave it periodically. Now it is the place, it's almost the only place for everything: eat, sleep, work, everything. So how has this affected the millennials in particular and their outlook on home ownership? Monique Johnson is lead real estate representative at Your Happy Realtor. She is also the creator of Newly Listed Toronto, and she joins me now. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. How are you doing today?
How has the pandemic impacted millennials and their outlook on home buying? Are they like, get me out of this rental apartment with roommates? No.
Well, the pandemic has been a game changer. Okay. With millennials, there's already an undercurrent in their mindset of how can they achieve financial independence the fastest way possible. Okay. Millennials are of the mindset is that they don't want to stay in jobs for 30 years, pay off a mortgage on a single home. They want to grow wealth for their own freedom so that they can live the lives they want with minimal restrictions. Okay. So that combined with, you know, super low interest rates and the environment they're in, they are jumping in with urgency.
I am very skeptical of the condominium market in major urban centers, particularly in Toronto, which is the city that I live in. And that is a market in which, you know, first-time homebuyers often participate because it's cheaper and it's urban and all that. Listings have doubled. Volume has fallen by almost 9% in the month of October. How might those declines affect the millennials' outlook?
So in terms of the declining condo market in the core, I do agree with you. I am skeptical as well. However, for some millennials, they're seeing it as opportunity. They understand that the pandemic has affected the condo market in terms of there's lack of travel, lack of Airbnb, lack of immigration that was a driving force with the condo market, and that is no longer. Prices are dropping, right? And active listings are up 155%. Okay. That is like staggering. Mm-hmm. So millennials are seeing that they can jump in now and they can get in for a lower price, which is rare in the core. And they understand that, you know, with the news of a vaccine, the fact that the government is opening their borders to, you know, over a million immigrants over the next 3 years, there's going to be a turn in the market eventually. So they're paying attention to that news and they're making wise decisions based on that.
Now, there are those who are considering moving outside of the core, whether it's the core in Toronto or Calgary or Vancouver or whatever, wherever you happen to live. What are you noticing? I mean, millennials don't necessarily have a partner. They don't necessarily have a kid. How are they thinking about that move to the pastoral lands of the Outer Hebrides?
So many of the millennials that I have been working with, they are cooped up in their condos. They're renting. They're paying anywhere from 25 to $3,000 a month for their rent. And some of them are okay with walking away from their leases and losing money on their leases in order to be able to purchase
really?
In the suburbs. Yes, yes, I'm seeing that more and more. So they are open to it. Some of them work in industries where they are bound to working from home indefinitely. They are seeing that that's their foreseeable future right now, and they want to make a change immediately. So millennials are savvy. They understand that, you know, if they can afford a home in the suburbs, that, you know, would equate the same payment for a mortgage that they are paying in rent right now in the core, make that move to the suburbs. And then what they're doing as well, they're finding properties that have rental suites in them. So they're offsetting their mortgage even more.
You've said that you've got the youngest clients of your career right now. So I can, yes. I can imagine that, there is a different way that they shop for homes because they are digital natives. They are on realtors.ca every 14 seconds. How do you work as their partner in a way that is different than if you were helping a baby boomer, for example, find a home?
So how a millennial client differs from a baby boomer? Millennials are looking to make as much money in the shortest amount of time. Whereas baby boomers, they're more looking at lifestyle. So baby boomers are buying with lifestyle in mind. So they're thinking about location. They're thinking about having land. They're thinking about perhaps even moving into the city. While millennials are looking to capitalize on the opportunity to make as much money as possible. So they are open to moving out of the city core into suburbs where they can rent portions of their home while they live on the main level or in the basement. And what they're doing is as their property has increases in equity year to year, right? They are refinancing their homes and buying new ones. Okay. So I have a client right now that I'm working with. They moved from the city into the suburbs. And this was 9 months ago. They called me last week saying they're ready to purchase their next home because they're trying to build their portfolio in a short amount of time.
It has been an unprecedented decade for real estate. Not everywhere, but in most parts of the country. And I think the reality is that interest rates cannot fall that much further. People's incomes are not increasing to the extent that prices are increasing. What is the note of caution that we need to strike with millennials who have never lived through a housing correction and who have probably never lived through a recession? How do you, I mean, you're in a tough spot because you want them to buy a house or sell a house and you get to earn the commission from that. But certainly there needs to be a note of caution here somewhere.
Right. So I always advise they should buy what they can afford. And I also advise that they should perhaps partner with other people so that they're not covering the costs of carrying a home by themselves. I also advise clients to look into buying properties where they can rent out a portion of it so they're not stuck should interest rates increase and they can afford their lifestyle. So it's really about buying where they can afford and making sure that they are in a situation where, you know, if they lose their job or if interest rates spike, they're able to maintain their payments.
Yeah. Interesting game. Boy, I'm glad I'm not a millennial.
Yeah. Well, they're very savvy. They get it. And, you know, I must say I'm proud. I am a millennial myself. And just to see that my peers are getting the fact that, you know, real estate is a safe investment. It has proven that they're not afraid to jump in.
Right. See, there's where your millennial-ness just bloomed in full sight because you were not around for the housing cratering of the late 80s or the 18% interest rates. Not to say that right. those things are going to happen, but people with a longer term sense of history would yes. tell you that real estate is not 100% safe. It certainly has been a great decade, but history is longer than a decade, isn't it?
Right. My parents they remind me of that time. But, you know, the millennials today, they're looking at the trends and they look at what the government is implementing, the policies that they're putting in place to kind of safeguard those kinds of massive corrections that have happened in the past. And, you know, I think the government has learned their lesson, perhaps, in how to safeguard interest rates so that we don't have that kind of massive correction.
Interesting. Well, we will watch with interest. Monique, thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Monique Johnson is a real estate representative at Your Happy Realtor and creator of Newly Listed Toronto. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, what Canadians are searching for online when it comes to personal finances. I'll speak with Fernando Agulo from SEMrush. He's joining us from Prague in the Czech Republic. And later, Monique Johnson is back for the Moolala questionnaire. If you'd like some more Moolala, you can download full episodes of this show on whatever platform you listen to, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, whatever it is. Or you can go to moolala.ca. If you pull down the podcast button or whatever you call it, there's a search box. So you can search topics of interest or guests of interest. And when you're listening to those podcasts, be sure to tap out a little review or subscribe. It really helps others find the show.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Using Google on your phone is so 2018. These days, you literally don't have to lift a finger to do a search. You just say, hey, Google, I should whisper it, unless she like answers in the background of the studio here. And Google will answer any question you have. But when it comes to your money, what are the most common answers people are looking for? SEMrush is a content marketing platform, and it has analyzed thousands of online searches across Canada relating to personal finance. Joining us now to talk about their findings is Fernando Agulo, SEMrush's head of communications. He joins us from Prague, Czech Republic. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for having me here today.
What is the single most common search Canadians are making when it comes to their money?
Oh, well, when it comes to personal finances, they are looking more right now more into TFSAs. Surprisingly, right?
They want to know about tax-free savings account. I'm surprised. I would have thought that it would have been, debt reduction or capitalizing on government benefits. But hooray that they're looking at TFSAs. Now, how does that compare versus their searches around RRSPs? Higher TFSAs are higher?
Oh yes, definitely. If we compare the data that we gather from the last 7 months, and we compare that for the previous year, we see an increase in 71% for TFSAs and only 45% increase for RRSPs.
You also found that car title loan searches skyrocketed. I don't even know what a car title loan search really is, but why were they up so much, do you think?
Oh, basically, this is one of the things that I was really surprised because we don't have that in Europe. In the United States, they have that, but their reaction was not there. For those search queries for the car title loans in the U.S., they are in the sixth place. In Canada, that's the third place for all Canadian searches. And that means that the number of Canadians searching for how to give their cars for a loan during this situation, that was their first reaction. So how much money I can get from my car to be thinking in a short term. So that was basically the first reaction. Okay, I'm going to be my car. How much money I can get from my car?
I think I could make a guess as to why your third finding makes sense. Payday loan searches down, 42%? Certainly the government stimulus and the government supports would have been a big help to those really living on the line here.
Oh, that's correct. Well, basically, when all the situation started, this was a very sad situation. Still, it is. Many people, they were just not receiving any paid as any check at the end of the month because they lose their jobs. So I'm not going to be asking for these microcredits, microloans, because I don't have any incomes to support that. So that's why we think that this decrease, so we see minus 42% on payday loans search queries. The behavior is basically clearly people were just losing their jobs.
People are also searching for the term financial advisor. That search increased by 22%. My optimist says that that's good. They're looking for some professional help.
Yes, that's something really interesting. And in comparison with other countries, so here we see that in Canada, the search for education in terms of finance is really high. And during this period of time, people who were searching not only for a real person, for the financial advisor, they were also searching for a robo-advisor. If you see the numbers there, the increase in comparison with the previous year is 14%. So financial advisor, the real person is there, but also robo, virtual advisors, the amount of searches has increased as well.
You mentioned a reference point to Canada versus other countries. Any other observations on how we are similar to or different from the kind of online searches that people are doing in other countries?
Oh, yes, definitely. The way Canadian people were reacting is pretty much similar as the people in the US, with the main difference in education loans. So, This is the top one for U.S. Customers, for U.S. People, but in Canada, it was basically everything related to tax deductions. If you can go for RSPs or TFSA, people were searching more about that. But in the United States, the only difference was the education loans. Right. That is another place in the Canadian top 10.
Yeah, well, student debt in the U.S. is markedly more dramatic and devastating than it is here in Canada. And our tax rate's higher. So, of course, we're trying to avoid tax at any cost. Fernando, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
Fernando Angulo is Semrush's head of communications. Their study was looking at online searches related to personal finance. And I'll tell you, most of it's pretty encouraging. Canadians are looking for more on TFSAs, financial advisors, robo-advisors. Hopefully, this is the time when people are getting a better handle on their money. Well, stay with us. Coming up next, Jackie Porter, certified financial planner. She's got an incredible story, and it's got a pretty good ending, too. So stick around for that. And we'll take Monique Johnson through the Moolala questionnaire. Now, I am also a money columnist for a show called Cityline. It airs across North America, and you can check out all those segments from me and from all the other Cityline experts at cityline.tv. So cityline.tv, there's decor, there's food, there's fashion, and there's me talking about money.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
A masterclass in resilience. Our next guest has had to walk through more than her fair share of fires to arrive at financial independence, but she has learned some very valuable lessons along the way. Jackie Porter is now a certified financial planner. She joins us now to talk about her financial journey and how that informs the work that she does with clients. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. How are you today?
I'm great. You came to financial planning later in life. You weren't doing it straight out of high school. You were not dealt the ideal set of cards when you were a teen. What is the essence of that experience, and what has your financial journey been like since then?
Yeah, I think for me, my mother passed away when I was 16, and those lessons have been with me because my mother was the kind of person who, she was fiercely independent. She made me that way. She was always saying to me from the tender age of like 7, never rely on a man, always have your own money. And those things just kind of stayed with me. And she was somebody who just believed in our immigrant like work ethic. She was very hardworking, and, you know, child labor laws aren't what they are now. And I know I'm probably dating myself, but that meant that typically all of the jobs she had, because she had lots of jobs on top of her full-time job, that she literally recruited me to. So I ended up being drafted into all the things she did. And all of those things just really taught me the value of working hard and of being independent. And, you know, she was just somebody who made me feel confident that I could do things, primarily because she was, you know, a single mom and, you know, babysitting wasn't what it used to be, right? It's certainly not what it is today. So I was left on my own a lot to fend for myself, do things. And I didn't realize it, but it just made me really confident. It made me really resilient. So, you know, fast forward to many years later, losing my mom and having to make adult decisions about, you know, figuring out how to put a roof over my head, food on the table. You know, I have to tell you that like the confidence that my mother placed in me and making me feel like I could do things like make lunch on my own at 7, walk home to school, walk home from school at the age of 7 and you know, be on my own. All of those things I didn't realize was teaching me resilience in real time. So I just, once she passed away, you know, started to move in with a friend, started to work a few jobs to pay the bills. And then, you know, I did that for a number of years through high school, through university. And I remember it was interesting to me, Bill, because Bruce, my apologies, that people just kept asking me for advice. They saw myself and my girlfriend living on our own and they thought that we knew something. And the truth is, the only thing we knew was how to work hard. And, you know, truthfully, that led me to getting, you know, I did work through jobs through high school, through university, got my first full-time job. So that led me to learn a lot about figuring out how to save money because I needed to figure out how to do that, figuring out how to be independent. And when I got my first full-time job, I just put away as much money as I could into all of the savings programs that were available to me because I actually became a really good saver over that time period. You know, I was somebody who was the queen of buying secondhand clothes because that's what I could afford, right? Buying antiques. And all of those things allowed me to eventually, while I was working for that company, buy my first home. And so I got downsized from my first job, which was also a lesson. And when I got downsized, I actually remember asking that same friend I was telling you about that I lived with, you know, I built up all this savings at this company. I'm not quite sure what to do with it. You know, she actually said to me, go talk to a financial planner. And I was probably 26 at that time. That was the first time I'd ever heard of the profession. And I finally sat down with a financial planner who, lucky for me, was a woman. And even more rare that I just came to realize many years later was a person of color and a female. And that was something that she was the first person I ever had a money conversation with. And, you know, she told me not only could I work for money, which is what my mom taught me, but that money could actually work for me. And truthfully, that was a game changer, Bruce, because no one ever talked to me about money working for me. And by the time I was 26, I had already been working for, you know, 10 years solid, and I was tired. So when she told me that money could work for me, I just kept thinking, I need to learn more and more about this industry because I need to figure out how money could work for me. I had been financially insecure for so long, renting and finally just getting my own place. I had, you know, struggled for so long. I just wanted to learn everything I could. And so I asked her about the profession, and that led me to, you know, get my certified financial planning designation, get all my licenses, create my 7-figure net worth. And from that point on, I started to think about all the people that looked like me, that never had a money conversation with anyone, and, you know, what a difference it could make for them as well.
Well, clearly, I would have liked your mother. She sounds amazing.
really?
And this amazing financial planner mentor, too. You have done many things. One of them is to co-author a book called Single by Choice or Chance. What is the single biggest insight that you want to pass along to women who are in that extraordinary circumstance?
Yeah, I think the biggest lesson is don't wait to start owning your financial future. Like, you deserve to have financial security, and only you can make that happen. Women live longer than men. We take a lot of time off to caregive. We also tend to earn less. And so the sooner that we come to the realization that we're the person that needs to become comfortable leaning into money conversations and taking care of our own future, the sooner like we feel we get the opportunity to feel good about the future we're going to create. Because I have to tell you that the truth is, it feels good to take the reins of your finances. It feels really good because no one else can promise you that. People die, people leave, and sometimes you want to leave. I'll never forget the client who came to me many years ago because she wanted a financial plan to figure out if she could leave her husband, if she could afford to leave her husband. And, you know, she never did, but she just wanted to know that if she wanted to, she could.
Hugely liberating, I can imagine. Now, listen, we've only got about a minute or so left. You have something called your 360-degree process. Every financial advisor has some sort of four-step, six-step, five-step, 180-degree, 360-degree, whatever it is. What is the one thing that you would say about how you approach that client engagement that is unique or different, or you would say is your superpower?
Yeah, I think my superpower is helping people like put all of the different documents, financial documents that they have, help them organize it, help them figure out how they should be thinking about it, help them figure out how it all relates and aligns to their money story. So sometimes people will tell me this is what they want. They want to save for retirement in a certain amount of time. But then I look at their documents and their documents tell me something different. So I'm like, my superpower is helping people align their money story with their documents and making sure that it all works and really making financial planning fun. I really hate boring. And I know my clients love leaning into stories, their own financial stories that actually captivate them, that we can make use humor in finance. We can.
We can't. No. It is boring. It is humorless. It is a terrible idea. We need more banker blue, and we need button-down shirts, and we need.
And complications. I know how much.
There is no way to make this simple. No.
I know, and the truth is, people's financial circumstances are complex, but not to them. They understand it well.
Right.
They just want to know if you understand it, right?
Right.
And so
the papers really are stored in the microwave oven. That's where they should be, of course. Jackie, we can clearly talk all day. I really appreciate you taking some time to share a bit of your story and your wisdom. Keep doing what you're doing with so many great people. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me here today. I really appreciate it.
Jackie Porter is a certified financial planner. She is also co-author of Single by Choice or Chance, The Smart Woman's Guide to Living Longer Better. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money and about life. Monique Johnson is a real estate representative at Your Happy Realtor. She is my guest. Monique, how would you describe your money personality? Because you have lots of personality, but I'm asking you your money personality.
My money personality, risky.
Risky. Okay. And was ever thus? It was always that way?
Always that way.
And what did that risk-taking willingness look like when you were younger?
In high school, I was telling my parents, let's refinance the family home so we can buy more homes. That's what I was telling my parents when I was 16 years old.
I love it. And did they do it?
No, they didn't. And they regret it to this day.
Right. Who was your money mentor growing up? Who did you learn from?
I learned from my parents, honestly. My parents, they were very conservative in their mindset with money. And, you know, I knew that I wanted to take risks and I knew that I wanted to spread the opportunity as wide as it could go. So I began investing very early, but just in terms of managing money to keep it and build enough to reinvest, I learned those principles from my parents.
What has been your best financial move?
Well, I would say so far, Bitcoin.
Yes.
My husband and I, we bought a few Bitcoins since October, and we've already made $15,000. In that short of time.
Wow. Okay. Yes. And what was your worst financial move on the other end of it?
my worst financial move was not buying real estate when I could, when I was.
Well, that's a missed opportunity. I'm not counting that, because that just reinforces your thesis that everybody should buy real estate and refinance and leverage their faces off and build a real estate empire. Okay. I mean, like an actual bad move. Did you ever buy a stock that went to zero or a house that turned out to be a money pit? Come on.
Yes. Okay. When 2008, the crash happened, I had my partner at the time told me, you know, let's invest in Franklin and Templeton. So I did so and lost all my money.
Ouch.
Not all of my money, the money that I invested in that particular stock.
Right. Yes. Right. What if you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior for your generation? Usually I say in society at large, but I would say for your generation, because I think there's something really powerful about the millennial group. Mm-hmm. What would it be? That was me snapping my fingers. Just okay. In case you don't, if you're not a big snapper, I don't know. Can you snap?
I can snap. Here we go.
You can?
Yes.
Oh, that's very good. It was very
so
good.
What I would say is the mistake that I see is they dump their money in their RRSPs. That is a mistake that I see, because a lot of the people that I have had conversations with, they safeguard their money. That mindset comes from their parents. Pile your money in RRSPs. And that money is not going to be working as aggressively as it could in other areas.
What would be an example? Instead of putting it into an RRSP, what do you think they should do?
I think they should buy. I'm sorry, but I'm going to go back to this thesis. But, you know, if you have, you know, 10 grand, 20 grand in RRSPs, purchase a property. Purchase a property. If you can't do it by yourself, find a peer, family member, or someone you can do it with. That's what I would say.
I love your one note wonder on real estate. You and I have a completely different view of the world.
Okay.
I started an RRSP when I was 16, and
yes.
It has absolutely been the best thing I ever did, because I think there's a really important distinction between retirement savings and the home in which you live. And you're obviously talking about investing in real estate, which is a different thing.
Right.
But the jury's out. The long-term trend on real estate versus the long-term trend on the stock market. The stock market outperforms real estate over long periods of time. Not in the last decade, and certainly not in Vancouver and Toronto, but in the long term. But I think you have drank the real estate Kool-Aid. It's clear.
I have.
And you're gargling the real estate Kool-Aid. All right, let me ask you one last question here. What does financial freedom mean to you?
Doing whatever you want, when you want, no matter the cost.
No matter the cost. You mean like the dollar's cost versus the cost to society or the cost to relationships?
Dollar's cost. Dollar's cost, of course.
What kind of person are you? You're like, I want a drink. I don't care if you don't like it. Oh.
That is my idea of financial freedom, is to be able to fund the life that you love.
Love it. Okay. What is one of the spending pleasures, the life that you love? What would it be? Is it travel? Is it food? Is it clothes? Is it shoes? Is it more Bitcoin?
Travel, nothing. In my opinion, traveling gives a whole, a new outlook on life, and every single destination can change your whole perspective on life. And it enriches our lives in ways that I think other experiences can't.
Well, now that is something we can agree on.
Yes.
That we can agree on, except for I go to a great destination and return home. You go to a great destination, buy a couple condos, and then return home. See how that works. You're like, I need to find a realtor. I know I'm on the Amalfi Coast, but I got to find a realtor.
Buy an apartment. And you know what? When my husband and I, when we do travel, we do check out the local real estate in the towns that we're in. We do.
Monique, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce.
That is the Moolala questionnaire. Our guest, Monique Johnson, real estate representative at Your Happy Realtor. That is our show for today. If you'd like to stay up to date on all things Moolala, our newsletter will do just that very thing. You can subscribe to it at moolala.ca. Also, here's a big idea. Subscribe to the podcast. So go to your podcast platform, hit the little subscribe button and leave us a review. We would love that. Even if it's like a scathing review, like Bruce is way too high energy. I've heard that already. I've heard it once or twice before. If you have comments or questions or criticisms that you want to send directly to my attention, ask@moolala.ca is the email address, ask@moolala.ca. If you want to send those comments or criticisms to the public, send them on social media. @BruceSelry is Twitter. BruceSelry Moolala is Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great day.